for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. The Justice Department finds systematic discrimination by police in Ferguson. A House panel subpoenas former Secretary of State Hillary Clinton's private emails and what the February job numbers could mean for interest rates. Here for the domestic hour of the Friday News Roundup, Manu Raju of Politico, John Harwood of CNBC, and Neil King Jr. of The Wall Street Journal. Throughout the hour, I'll look forward to hearing from you. Call us on 800-433-8850. Send an email to drshow@wamu.org. Follow us at Facebook or send us a tweet. Happy snowy Friday, everybody.
Hi, Dan.
Happy snowy day to you, too.
Happy snow day, Diane. I have to admit, though, I'm a little intimidated because Neil King has the greatest broadcasting voice in the history of mankind.
And I am welcoming Neil King back.
It's a pleasure to be back. It really
is. So good to have you.
Even on a sloppy day.
Well, and let me just tell our listeners, you can watch this program if you simply go to drshow.org and click on Watch. It's right at the top of the website. Now, Neil, the Labor Department reports the economy added 295,000 jobs last month, takes the unemployment rate to 5.5. What is happening with the economy?
It's just the job market in particular is on a tear. It's pretty extraordinary. So the recession ended essentially in June of 2009. At that time, the unemployment rate was 9.5. It's now 5.5. I think it's been 12 months now in a row of over 200,000 jobs a month. We haven't seen a stretch like that since 1984. Amazingly, now we're hearing the term full employment, which would seem a little odd at 5.5% unemployment. But we're in the band now where the Federal Reserve has to think about whether the job market is getting so tight that they would call it full employment. And that raises, of course, the discussion of when it is they're going to raise rates. And now, even today, you hear a lot more clamoring among economists. They should start to do that. I don't think they're likely to do that until June at the earliest, probably later in the year. But it's a sign of a very strong job market with just the one oddity that I will mention, and that is that wages so far haven't really started to show the kinds of gains that you would see with the labor market that would seem to be as tight as it is. The wage gains are about 2% a year. That's a really fairly average, if not even a little bit flat. So that's the big mystery, is we have a tight market that still seems to show a fair bit of slack.
So you do not think that these good job numbers are going to change the minds of the Fed?
I think what they'll do is that in their next meeting, they will change the guidance language a little bit to indicate that there is a rate change coming. It's very unlikely. I haven't read everything since I merged into here, and maybe the conventional wisdom has shifted a little bit that they're likely maybe to move as early as June. I would doubt that. They will move sometime probably in the second half of the year.
What do you think, John Harwood?
There's a big debate between June and September. I tend to think it's more likely to happen in September than in June. I think there's still a bias in economic analysis to be skeptical of just how strong the economy is. Consider the forecasts of this job number before it came out this morning. People were saying, well, 220,000 jobs. It was 295. We keep surprising on the upside. And until people fully appreciate the and get comfortable with the idea that this labor market is tightening rapidly and the economy is really rolling, you're going to have a bias to let's wait just a little bit longer.
And what about hiring, Manu?
Yeah, that's a big question as well. You know, and part of what the Fed will, of course, look at, too, is how much wages are increasing. And as Neil alluded to, I mean, there's this jobs report showed a 3-cent increase in the hourly wages, and that's only about a 0.1 1% increase. It's a little bit lower than what economists had forecast, and it's still down from about the 12-cent increase that we saw in January. So once we start seeing this robust gain in wages, then I think that you'll see the Fed sort of take its foot off the gas.
And Diane, the other thing it does is it cements the shift politically that we're seeing as we run up to the 2016 presidential campaign from talking about how do we get this economy going to talking about how do we get the fruits of the economy distributed in a way that helps average people as well as people who are doing very well at the top.
So you've got organizations like Walmart announcing in advance a $10 minimum wage. How is that likely to reshape what other large companies are thinking, Neil?
Well, you're seeing a trend afoot in that area where a number of larger retailers are pushing up their floor, you know, wage floor, essentially. An employer as large as Walmart, that actually starts to make a bit of a difference in changing the overall wage complexion around the country, and particularly because Walmart is big and very active in a lot of parts of the country where wages are not that high. So it's a little bit different than if you're talking about New York City or you know, the Chicago area or L.A. And I think one of the big questions that even when Walmart made that move was never totally clear was this a bit of a sort of social statement on their part, a kind of a goodness of their hearts? And I think there was some element of that. I think there's been a lot of pressure put on a lot of these bigger retailers. But also whether or to what extent it was just a reflection of a tightening job market and higher competition for wages. So far, interestingly, we've seen most of the really intense increases, and there haven't been many intense increases on the wage side, in the restaurant industry, oddly enough, which has been one of the fastest growing areas and also, of course, one of the lowest wage growth areas. One of the reasons that we see wages being low is that where we are seeing increases is in the really low end of the wage scale, and we're not seeing a lot of that on the higher end, and particularly in the addition of jobs on that side. So you're not seeing a lot of people coming into the labor market making a lot of money compared to the number that are coming into the labor market making relatively little.
Diane, on Walmart, I lean toward the second of the two factors that Neil mentioned. Yes, every company wants good PR. But Walmart fundamentally is a conservative company that does things when it needs to do them, and that's a reflection of the fact that this labor market is tightening, and they are trying to get ahead of that.
How tight is the labor market?
I mean, that's a great question. I don't think I can answer that right now. I mean, that's one thing that the economists are going to have to evaluate over the next couple months and as we view the March job numbers next month. I mean, clearly, this is good news for the White House. This is going to be something that the White House will actively trumpet, and it's something that the Democrats wish that they did more of in the midterm elections last year. They view this as something that the president, a legacy of the president, turning around the economy and putting it in a solid footing. But we'll see how how wages pick up and other factors of the economy improve as well.
Could it, that is, the growing numbers, could that affect political thinking in the Congress as to how it moves, what it does, what it goes up against, what it backs off from?
Can we determine what affects the thinking of Congress these days? That's a difficult one. It's hard to see how it really affects policy per se. I think, for instance, the federal minimum wage thing is not only effectively dead for now, but it's so much moved to the states and in part moved to the companies themselves, as we saw with Walmart, that it's hard to see that happening. I think the interesting ferment that we're going to see, in my mind, is among individual members of Congress putting forward ideas in the way that Mike Lee and Marco Rubio just floated their sort of fix to the tax code. There's going to be a lot of competition, particularly among the sort of 2016 types or the more prominent members of Congress, particularly in the Senate, to show that they have interesting, innovative thinking on trying to change the equation. Because no matter whether we are seeing these strong growth in the job numbers, but at the same time, there is sort of a flatness about the economy, particularly on the wage front. And that's going to be the sweet spot, I think, as John was alluding to, of the 2016 campaign, is what to do about that.
You look out for also how the Republicans, when they propose their budget in the spring, in April, March and April, how much they view improvement in the economy and whether or not that they will push forward with aggressive round of spending cuts, how they're going to deal with sequestration that's still going into effect. That's going to be a huge question for the Republicans, particularly if they sense that the economy is picking up. Does it make sense to continue with sharp spending cuts, or does it make sense to go even further? That'll be a big indication in the next several weeks exactly which direction they want to go.
Diane, it is so hard for this Congress to do anything, by which I mean anything, that it's hard to project a policy shift. You may have thinking in the shift in the thinking of individual members of Congress. You may have shifts in rhetoric that show up in the 2016 campaign. But as much trouble as they had funding the Department of Homeland Security, excuse me, it's very hard to see substantive economic legislation moving through this Congress.
You know, it's interesting because about an hour and 15 minutes after the job numbers came out, Jack Lew put out a statement saying that the debt ceiling drum is now beginning to beat. As of, I think, the 16th of March, the Treasury Department is going to have to go on a sort of extraordinary measures, and we're going to run up against the ceiling in September, if not earlier. That's going to be an interesting drama as it plays out.
Neil King, Global Economics Editor, Deputy Washington Bureau Chief at the Wall Street Journal. Short break here. When we come back, we'll talk about what's happening in Ferguson.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from CA Technologies, who believes that in the application economy, every business is in the software business. CA makes software to empower enterprises and help them thrive. More information is at ca.com. From PwC, the right people to get the extraordinary done. Learn more at pwc.com/extraordinary. And from the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, working together to build a culture of health for all. On the web at rwjf.org.
Welcome back to the Domestic Hour of our Friday News Roundup, this week with Neil King Jr. of the Wall Street Journal, John Harwood of CNBC, and the New York Times, Manu Raju. He's a reporter at Politico. On our discussion about the economy, here's an email from Marilyn. She says, for 6 years, Republicans shouted Obama was destroying our economy. Now, as the economy just keeps on improving, and Supreme Court briefs argue the ACA actually has a positive effect on economics, I cannot think of a single thing Republicans did to help the recovery. Their signature action is shutting down the government. Do they now argue that was the magic bullet in the positive economic news, Neil King?
That's a good point, particularly to the extent that, you know, there was, when it comes to the Obamacare, Affordable Care Act, there was very much this sense that it would whack the job market, that it would lead to not just layoffs, but reduction in work hours. We haven't seen either the reduction in the work hours, and we certainly haven't seen the layoffs. And there was a lot of commentary on that front this morning, a lot of people sort of tweeting the charts and whatnot, seeing that we've had this extraordinary run of over 200,000 jobs a month, basically since Obamacare became, you know, a full-blown law. So we're not seeing the impact that many had predicted.
Republicans have made the argument that when they retook the House in 2010 and sort of put the brakes on what they called out-of-control spending by the Obama administration, as reflected in the stimulus program as well as the health care law, that that somehow had a confidence effect. But you have to say, looking back not only to the doomsaying predictions of Obama's economic program, but to the doomsaying predictions of President Clinton's economic program as well, that most of what the dire effects that Republicans have predicted from Democratic presidents over the last generation has simply been proven false by the numbers. Now, they can make the counterfactual argument and say, well, had X, Y, and Z not happened, the economy would be even stronger. But that's a difficult argument to look at and give a lot of credence to.
Yeah, and I think that's why you're actually seeing the Republican presidential race start to shift on national security issues. I mean, clearly, there are major issues that are happening overseas, war with ISIS, what's happening in Ukraine, et cetera. But it's also because the economy is doing better, and it's much harder for Republicans to simply whack Obama over the economy when there are positive trends in the economic forecast. And that's a big sign of how the Republican presidential nomination may go and forward. This may be a national security election, not necessarily one on the economy.
All right, let's turn to Eric Holder's report from the Department of Justice slamming the Ferguson police force this week. Talk a bit about what that report had to say, John.
Well, you have to look at that as a bookend to the other finding that they issued, which is that they were not going to bring civil rights charges against Darren Wilson, the officer who shot Michael Brown. It is difficult to bring civil rights cases because of the high bar standard of proof. Eric Holder has said, as he's preparing to leave office, assuming the Republicans do get around to confirming Loretta Lynch, that we need a lower bar in some of those cases so they're easier to bring. But in tandem with that, they looked at the practices of the Ferguson Police Department and found that African Americans were disproportionately singled out, that there was good reason for the unhappiness that residents of Ferguson, black residents of Ferguson, had been expressing, in part because it was an attempt through traffic fines and other things to make money to fund the government.
And the routine use of tasers, unnecessary force, and as John said, disproportionately used against blacks, Neil.
I find this whole sort of predatory fining thing to be really extraordinary and by no means limited at all to Ferguson. This is something the president also received this policing task force report at the beginning of the week that was also singling out this kind of, basically, you know, it's sort of a local kleptocracy in a way, where you have communities basing their revenue stream off of onerous fines, particularly the kind of fine that you get a speeding camera fine and it's $100 and you can't pay it, or you pay part of it and then you get an additional fine, and pretty soon the $100 fine becomes $600 as it grows, while people that are, it's one of these things that highlights this sort of inequality theme that so many of us have been talking about. And it may in the end be even more legitimate source of deep grievance in a place like Ferguson than a lot of the, so, you know, more what we think of as police conduct, like the use of tasers.
And Neil is right in the very first thing he said, which is this stands for much more than Ferguson.
Of course. Of course.
Yeah, and as part of that report, there were about 24 policy changes that the Justice Department urged Ferguson to implement, everything from more supervision, more civilian oversight, a new disciplinary system. This is something that if Ferguson does not agree to, I think you may see the Justice Department try to force the issue through the courts and force Ferguson to implement these changes.
But the big question remains, is the police chief going to resign? Does he have to resign in order for the population of Ferguson to believe that real change will occur?
Potentially, yeah. I mean, that's going to be a huge issue that they're going to have to deal with. I mean, the Ferguson mayor, James Knowles, acknowledged that there were problems, but also sort of downplayed them as well. He said that they're making some changes. He said they were cooperative with the Justice Department. But at the same time, he sort of limited it to a few bad actors. He said there were those racially charged emails were only coming from a handful of people.
One person has been let go, but the other two, that action is pending.
That's right. That's right. So how the mayor and how they proceed on this, it remains a big question going forward, and especially whether or not the police chief keeps his job.
Diane, one postscript related to Congress on the issue that I talked about a moment ago, the standard of proof in civil rights prosecutions. Holder called for a lower standard. I interviewed the other day Orrin Hatch, who's now the chairman of the Finance Committee, used to be chairman of the Judiciary Committee. He said, absolutely not. The standard is plenty low if you have the facts on your side, and they simply didn't have a powerful set of facts to support a prosecution of Darren Wilson. So that shows that Eric Holder expressed this desire, not likely to be gratified by this Congress anytime soon.
What do you think, Neil?
Yeah, I mean, it's I don't know if it's irony is the right word, but of this whole report is that it basically vindicated the grand jury finding that there was, on most of the factual points that we came to all understand, and there was obviously so much focus on at the time, Darren Wilson's story was not eroded and more or less held up. The thing
there that was conflicting evidence that apparently they could not include.
Yeah, I mean, it wasn't as if this report had revealed that the grand jury was wrong by any means, right? But I still continue to think the things that were most revealing and most important for a national discussion is less has to do with Ferguson per se, which is obviously a small suburb of St. Louis, but whether these policies, so many of which are national in scope, need to be changed. And I don't know whether this is something that comes through the Justice Department or through the White House as part of this task force that Obama has put into order. But there's obviously the need for some changes, just sort of state by state or locality by locality.
Specifically in Ferguson, there's, this issue is not over yet. I mean, Michael Brown, his family said they're going to bring a civil suit against Darren Wilson over this. In the civil suit, of course, there's a much lower bar to clear. You have to clear a preponderance of evidence rather than beyond a reasonable doubt. This is something that's going to continue to be in the news and continue to put pressure on the Ferguson Police Department.
In the category of all politics is local, there are a lot of jurisdictions around here in the Washington, D.C. area, which is a much more affluent area, obviously, that have gotten addicted to the revenue from photo speed cameras all over the place.
And
I know that personally.
You know that personally. Well, I happen to believe that these cameras are slowing people down. And if that happens and you got a ticket for that, probably a good thing.
Fair enough.
Emails in Ferguson, emails from Hillary Clinton reminds you you should never write an email you don't want to see on the front page of the Wall Street Journal, New York Times, anywhere. So, Hillary Clinton's emails, Manu, what's the accusation here? The House has subpoenaed her emails.
That's right. When she was Secretary of State, Hillary Clinton exclusively used private email to conduct public business. Now, this was revealed in a New York Times report on Monday. The Associated Press later reported in the week that not only did she use her personal email to conduct private business, public business, but they also maintained control of their own server that was linked to their family home in New York. Now, this seems to be a pretty extraordinary effort by a public official to circumvent public scrutiny over things that she's been writing over government official government business, things that could be by using her private email, congressional investigators, journalists through the Freedom of Information Act would have a much harder time accessing that. So the question now is whether or not she complied with federal regulations that require these emails to be part of the public record, as well as whether or not she complied with State Department policy, which said very clearly, dating back to 2005, that public officials need to, in the State Department, must do their work on public email. So this House committee that's investigating the Benghazi attacks from 2012 subpoenaed Clinton's records. She is has so far turned over 55,000 emails about 2 months ago to the State Department. They have not been publicly released yet. The question is exactly what emails she turned over, how she made that decision on which emails to turn over, and what constitutes her public work versus her private work.
All right. Here's an email from Joseph in White Lake, Michigan. Why not just ask her to turn over the server to the State Department or a third party to extract all the non-personal emails? Examining the server is the only way to know if she's produced all the emails relating to her position as Secretary of State.
I would not be surprised if it comes to that at some point. I have to, Manu referred to the AP report. I have to salute the headline writer at the AP who came up with the term homebrew email server, which is one of the great turns of phrase that I can remember recently.
Could those emails have been more protected from anybody breaking in to her emails than had they been on the State Department server?
It's actually an interesting point, and a number of people have raised that. And the presumption has been, and certainly the presumption within the State Department has been, stay on our servers. That's the most protected place you can be. But the reality is that the White House has had its problems.
Right.
They've been problems all throughout government. It's hardly some impregnable zone. And I think there have been people who have made the case that it's very possible that her, you know, server in New York was a better server in terms of its security than
the
State
Department. It's not like it was a Wayne's World kind of server. You're talking about a former president of the United States.
Exactly.
And a former senator.
Exactly.
To me, what's so funny, I mean, there's so much about this that says so much about Hillary Clinton. I love the Times had that great story about how it became this status symbol within her realm to have your email be their domain name. You know, email. And it's all the kind of weird inner prestige element of it, this hyper secrecy. It points to so much of what people fear about this whole kind of Clinton juggernaut in some way. And the fact that she had nobody to protect her flank kind of on the press side because she's kind of dormant. She hasn't started her campaign yet. She's taking this incoming fire. She hasn't exactly responded in the most laudable fashion this week in terms of what you would give you the sense that there's a fleet-footed kind of operation going on in her.
And
state.
You're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. Here's an email from Bob in Martinsburg, West Virginia. Does your panel believe the email scandal regarding Hillary really resonates with the general public, or is this more of a beltway and pendant issue?
Well, it's clearly much more of a beltway and press and partisan issue, but that's still a problem for Hillary Clinton. Whether or not the public focuses in on the details of this scandal, which they surely will not, the sustained attention to the question of whether Hillary Clinton is straightforward and open and honest, which is something that has sort of dogged her for since she was first lady, is not helpful to her campaign. And her people know it. They're trying to figure out how to deal with it now. As Neil indicated, there was nobody there to protect her with the clout or the inclination to protect her at the time she became Secretary of State by saying, hey, look, maybe we should just default to the State Department server rather than something that could feed this impression long run. And we're going to have to see how long this thing lasts to determine how much.
Yeah, I would say there are two things about the timing of this. One is that it's happening early enough that by the time of November 2016 rolls around, I'm not sure how many people will be talking about this. But the second thing is that it comes at a very difficult time for Hillary as well, because she's trying to begin the rollout of her campaign. And in some ways, this may pressure her to come out earlier because the longer she waits, as Neil and John are alluding to, she has a skeletal organization right now and not much in which she can respond. She needs some cover and to push back very aggressively and have a clear message about what she's talking about on the campaign trail, fill the void, because the void right now is being filled about this email issue. But at the same time, she doesn't want to come out too early, because then the initial rollout of her campaign will be dogged by the same email issue.
And so, the president of the United States, who she served, and his staff are being very cautious in how they talk about this, as they should, because they didn't have full control over her decision-making on that issue. And so they're making statements to the press, which is it's come to dominate their daily press briefings, and saying, we count on the Clinton team to have handled this. And that is mixed cover at best.
Just to go back to your point in the beginning, this will all come down to whether she did indeed send emails that will somehow or other come back to haunt her. And the likelihood, I'm not going to bet on whether that's the case, but I think for the most part, people on that level try to keep the things that might haunt them off of email.
Neil King, John Harwood, Manu Raju, all here to answer your questions. After a short break, stay with us.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from CarMax, offering more than 35,000 used cars and trucks. Online and in stores from coast to coast. Learn more at CarMax.com. From Carbonite, providing secure and automatic backup and recovery for businesses and homes. Since 2005, Carbonite has recovered nearly 40 billion files for its customers, from accounting databases to family photos. Learn more at Carbonite.com. And from the listeners who support this NPR station.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, the Friday News Roundup, the Israeli Prime Minister slams the Obama administration over a possible nuclear deal with Iran. Venezuela demands the U.S. sharply reduce its staff in Caracas, and thousands in Russia mourn the murder of a Kremlin critic. The Diane Rehm Show, next hour.
Thank you.
And welcome back. We've got lots more to cover in this hour. First, I want to go to the phones, 800-433-8850, to Jane in Orleans, Massachusetts. Hi, you're on the air.
Good morning. Nice to talk with you.
Thank you.
I've been waiting a long time to say these things because I haven't heard anyone speak about it on your program or any of the others that I've seen or in the newspaper anywhere, and that is the plight that those of us who live on a fixed income pretty much and some modest savings are facing, not being able to buy CDs, which are the safe thing that I always and many others always invested in through the years. Mr. Bernanke promised, I believe, in 2013 to raise the rates, and we're still going on guessing when the feds will raise the rates. But this is a total non sequitur that nobody is paying attention to those of us who are not doing the stock market because we cannot do
that. I understand that very well, Jane, and indeed that issue has been raised previously, but I'm glad you did so again to remind us. Neil?
It's a fabulous point. I mean, we are living in this weird moment. It's not just the nation, but the world where, yes, we can point to signs of economic growth and we can point to signs that the job market is heating up, but where there's this flatness that's reflected in we don't have deflation here, but we have these extremely low inflation numbers. And essentially, you know, the reality of the Fed living at this essentially zero short-term interest rate environment is that you can get maybe 1% or 2% at most on your money if you put it in for a long term. And that really hurts particularly those that are older on fixed incomes that don't want to take the risk of being in the market. And it is a problem. And it's also one that's hard to see how it's going to turn around. And
John, I want to move to Prime Minister Netanyahu's speech on Tuesday. And we heard shortly thereafter that Congress wanted to hold a vote next week on a bill requiring congressional approval of any Iran deal. Now it looks as though they're backing off. Talk about the reaction to Netanyahu's speech generally.
Well, first of all, it was a very powerful speech, very well delivered by Benjamin Netanyahu, who, of course, is immensely familiar with the United States, has appeared multiple times before Congress. And he stated the case based in fear, concern, skepticism about Iran, that this is going to be a bad deal. And it is not going – the time limit is bad. Allowing Iran to have some sort of nuclear infrastructure, even if not toward the production of a nuclear weapon, is dangerous and will allow them to break out and have a bomb and trigger a nuclear arms race in the Middle East. The point from the administration and from Democrats, who, by the way, blocked – Mitch McConnell's plan that you mentioned to accelerate that vote, is that, yes, there are reasons to be concerned about the deal. It's not an optimum deal. It doesn't solve all of our problems. Their point and the president's point is it's better than the alternative. And there was no alternative that is credible that Bibi Netanyahu offered. He said, you know, no, the alternative to this deal is not war. It's a better deal. What is a better deal, and how could you obtain one? We don't even know if Iran's going to take the one they're talking about
exactly.
Right now.
The thing that was extraordinary, just from the sheer theater, and it was amazing theater, is that you had a foreign leader come into the floor of the House to a rousing standing ovation that was quite prolonged, in order explicitly to criticize and take down a very active policy underway by the President of the United States, with a huge reception by a large part of the House, of Congress overall, at the exact time that his Secretary of State in Switzerland was actually talking with the foreign minister of Iran. I mean, it was beyond unprecedented in its moment in that regard. And it's interesting because politically, as John pointed out, the Republicans loved it for the most part. But if you talk to conservative foreign policy people who are intimately involved, or not necessarily involved in, but aware of the details of Iran front, and also of just the importance of how these things come off. There was a lot of anger that Netanyahu took this step, and there's also a lot of fear among people who are close to Israel that this could do longer-term damage by having politicized Israel's standing in the U.S. in ways that are rather unprecedented.
What about the election in Israel?
That was one of the things that the skeptics were saying, that this is why he's here, to help his own political chances going forward. But I do think it really hardened the opposition at a crucial moment right now. Of course, the United States is engaged in multilateral negotiations and trying to get some sort of rough framework by March 24th. And the Democrats in Congress, who are skeptical of this Iran deal, have agreed to wait until after that March 24th deadline to push for either new sanctions or this idea of giving congressional approval to whatever deal the administration reaches. So after that March 24th deadline, I think it's going to be very hard for those same Democrats to endorse whatever the United States agrees to. I think that you probably are going to see a very strong push, a bipartisan push, for congressional consent of this deal, particularly if it's one that Israel doesn't like. And it will be very hard for the White House to sustain a veto if it ends up getting to that point.
Do you believe that hard to sustain a veto if he gets the deal he wants?
Oh, that's a tough calculus to make in the Senate in terms of where people would come down.
I don't think that would happen, Diane. I don't think the Democratic Party would allow a Democratic president to be smacked down in that way. So I don't think they'd be able to get the votes.
And what about the U.S. citizens' reaction to John Boehner going around the president, even to invite the prime minister to speak, knowing that the president was not consulted at all?
We did polling on that. Basically, you know, people aren't hugely intimately involved in all or aware of all the details of this, but there was not great appreciation for how this was done. I think it was something like a quarter that were supportive, something like that, in a poll that we had done, and much larger among Republicans. But even among Republicans, there was not a majority support for Boehner having done what he did.
But it goes to the override point, Diane. It hardened the opposition, as Manu said, but it also partisanized the opposition and in a way that would make it easier to hold Democrats together in support of the president.
But there's a reason why Boehner did that. I mean, he wasn't really concerned about the larger American public and how they view this move. He was concerned about how the House Republican Conference views this. And clearly this was a very thing that the House Republicans wanted. They enjoy when their speaker sticks the finger in the eye of the White House. And that helped his internal politics, and particularly at a difficult time for the speaker after this cave on the Department of Homeland Security spending bill. It was no surprise that that happened on the same day that the Netanyahu speech happened, because he was in a pretty strong position with his Republican conference. So all this has to do a lot with his own internal standing.
All right. And Chris Saliza of the Washington Post at The Fix is tweeting, "No one in the House GOP leadership is going to Selma." His conclusion, not smart. What do you make of that? John Boehner has said Republican ranks do not include a single member of the House Republican leadership in this converging on Selma, Alabama, for a large commemoration of a civil rights anniversary. What do you make of that?
I doubt it has a big political ramification. I talked yesterday to the staff of Martha Roby, a member from Alabama, who was recruiting Republicans to go. They have more Republicans going this time than they ever have before, 18 House members, 5 senators. President George W. Bush will also be present. I think from John Boehner's standpoint, he would feel that it's a little bit of a no-win situation, that he would be going down to try to make a point, but he'd be making a point with an audience that is not at all on his side, the side of House Republicans, and a visit would dramatize and punctuate that point.
But gosh, the picture is larger than that, it seems to me, John. I mean, this is a huge commemoration.
But I think George W. Bush can, his presence alongside President Obama can stands for Republicans in a fairly powerful
what
way.
What do you think, Manu?
You know, I don't think they fully thought this through. I'm not sure if the Republican leadership, I don't think they made a calculated decision not to go. I think that they probably had scheduling conflicts and didn't clear their schedule out. And at the end, pressure came on and they continued to go on with their own schedules.
Scheduling conflicts, Neil.
Well, I mean, they had a little bit more advance warning on this one, to say the least, than Obama did when it came to the huge march in Paris after the Hebdo killings. But on the other hand, that was one of those just like human moments where, whoa, they just didn't really know this was going to be happening and receiving the attention that it did. Who knows? Maybe there's still time. Maybe John Boehner will decide to jump on a plane.
And it also looks bad. Like Steve Scalise, the House Majority Whip, he came under a lot of criticism after revelations that he once spoke at a white supremacist group. He is not going to this event either. Clearly, this is not the headline that they
All right. I suspect he would not be well received at the Selma March.
All right. Let's go to Cleveland, Ohio. Hi there, Carl. You're on the air.
Good morning. I was calling from Cleveland, and I was going to say children have a right to play, you know, regarding Ferguson and the things that have happened. And I believe they also have that we have to respect, and they should have the right to be shielded from toxic commercialism, where it involves legitimizing, you know, evil acts in our society. Look, we have teaser commercials on at 8 p.m. in the evening now saying American crime and showing bloody scenes on our TV screen that are contrived. And children get exposed to these because of the lack of family. And our rec centers here in Cleveland, I'll tell you what, they're not open all the time, and there's not enough mentors there.
Well, I fully agree. Play is important. Play takes a lot of stress and tough emotion out of the atmosphere. Part of what's happening across this country, not paying enough attention to infrastructure, including playgrounds.
That is true. I would say children's play is a bipartisan issue, but support for public appropriations to add parks and fix roads and a whole range of infrastructure things is not. And I think there are people in many cities in the United States who would sympathize with the caller's argument.
Absolutely. And you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. Neil King, the president, signed a clean Department of Homeland Security funding bill. Talk about what this says about the drama going on within the Republican Party.
You know, I always kind of look at this a little bit as there's a big canal, something like the Panama Canal, and how wide is that canal? And the Republicans sort of thought the canal was widened a little bit in terms of what they can move through it because of the takeover of the Senate. But now they're finding out, much to their chagrin, that it really hasn't been widened all that much. But the House Republicans haven't really come to understand that. So they keep crafting these things that are just too big to fit through the opening that exists in the Senate, much to the chagrin of John Boehner and much to the undermining of what authority he has.
I think the House Republicans want to seize the Panama Canal again.
Maybe that too. You know, Manu could certainly speak much more wisely to the inner dynamics of this, but when I watched that vote play out, I said, wow, these are the kind of numbers that we could imagine seeing on a whole bunch of things. There's the export-import bank reauthorization that has to come up by June. You look at that, you say, uh-huh, I could see a vote like that, if it even comes up, which I can imagine it won't now. You think of a whole range of things, a highway bill, we were talking about infrastructure, the appropriations bill. There are going to be a number of things. To talk about fast track for having to move forward on some of these trade bills, numbers we could see also very similar. He has a big flank of protest votes of people that aren't keen to follow his leadership, and that's going to haunt him for the rest of his time.
The challenge is going to be the math going forward. I mean, in the Senate, there are 54 Republican seats. They need 60 to break a filibuster, 67 to override a veto. In the House, there's a hard right faction of 25 no votes on most things that John Boehner will do. And on this, when he tried to advance a three-week Homeland Security spending bill, there were 52 no votes. And I think that's going to be a very difficult thing for them to thread. And the House Republican leaders will tell you, look, we can't just turn around and pass centrist legislation because we're going to lose a lot of votes. And we're also not going to win a lot of Democratic votes because a lot of these blue dog Democrats have been wiped out. They've lost their elections in recent years. So each chamber has much different math problems, which is going to make it very difficult to reconcile big bills in the next couple of years.
And speaking of Democrats, Barbara Mikulski has chosen to retire at the end of 2016. Big scramble for her seat.
There is. This was not expected, even though she's 78 years old. She had signaled that she was going to run again, and she had made a decision not to. So there are a whole bunch of very ambitious Democrats from Maryland who've been waiting for this moment.
What do you think changed her mind?
You know, I'm not entirely sure. Sometimes it's just a very personal decision. She's been in office for 28 years. She leaves a pretty lasting legacy. She's the longest woman to serve in Congress. Clearly, this is something that she thought it was the right time to do and that there was a time for a new generation. And Chris Van Hollen, the congressman from Maryland, has already said he's going to run, but he could face a very contentious Democratic primary from other members of the delegation, other state and local officials who are considering running. It's a seat that will likely stay in Democratic hands, but Maryland has been quirky. In the last election, they elected a Republican governor, and Republicans think they may have an outside chance.
And quickly, Neil, what did we learn from the Supreme Court hearing on the Affordable Care Act?
We learned that there's a very divided court. We learned that even among the people that would likely be in support of the plaintiffs in this case, in basically depriving these subsidies of the states that they're in, that there's a lot of concern for the shock that would occur in the country and the possibility that they would take an action and then move to sort of defer it or stay it so that these number of people, 7.5 million or so, wouldn't lose their health care subsidies.
Neil King, The Wall Street Journal, John Harwood, CNBC, and The New York Times, Manu Raju of Politico. Thanks for a great news roundup.
Thanks, Diane.
Thanks, Diane. We'll follow up later on your private server.
Okay. Thanks for listening, all. I'm Diane Rehm.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkert, Denise Couture, Susan Casey, Rebecca Kaufman, Lisa Dunn, Danielle Knight, Allison Brody, and Alexandra Boti. The engineer is Toby Schreiner. Natalie Yurev-Lifker answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives and podcasts. Call 202-885-1200 for more information.